start recording. This is an interview with Kit Clark on Wednesday, August the 20th, 2008, at her home in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Kit.
Hi, Yana. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'd like to start off with our first question, which is tell me a little bit about where you're from and what you're doing now.
Where I'm from?
Yeah.
You mean where I grew up?
Yes.
Well, I grew up down in a farm in Deeply County. And then I came to Raleigh in 1945, and I've been here ever since.
And when you moved to Raleigh, you had your own business, didn't you?
Well, after I went to school, yes. I started an insurance agency back in 1952. And then, of course, I started a bookstore in 1975. I was always doing something different.
I want to say that's kind of unusual for a woman back then to have her own business, wasn't it?
Yes, they would not allow me to join the insurance association here. So turned out there were quite a lot of women working in the office, so we formed our own association.
You did.
And I understand it's still active. So they couldn't keep us out. They could discriminate against us, but they couldn't keep us out.
Well, while you're running your insurance business, that's the time that you met Lewis Clark, right?
That's correct. A friend of mine worked at Ford Motor Company that was just a few blocks from my office. And he sold a car to Lewis. And at that time, the state had just come out with the liability insurance law. You could not operate a car without liability insurance. And Lewis was in a hurry to get up to Boston to see his friends. He had been down here just 1 year. So he asked Bert to take care of the insurance for him. So Bert called me and said, he teaches at State College. I think it's safe to write the insurance. He'll pay you when he gets back. So I wrote the policy and sent the forms to the state. And about 2 weeks later, he came to the office, and that's how I met him.
What did you think of him when you first met him?
He looked like a little boy. He was wearing shorts and some strange-looking sandals. T-shirt that was much too big for him. And had a strange accent. That was my initial impression.
And so how long after that was it before you started going out?
About a month later, he had an accident and totaled his car. And he started coming up to the office every day. When was he going to get a check so he could get his car fixed? But he didn't want the car fixed. He wanted to get a different car. And the adjuster agreed with him. But it did take about 2 weeks to get his check because they had to get the police report and all that stuff. And since he was out of school for the summer, he had nothing to do except show up at my office every day. And one day he invited me to have lunch with him. And we walked across the street to the Mecca restaurant, which is still in Raleigh, and had lunch. And I ordered the fried chicken, and he called it battered bones. But that was the start of it all.
So how long was the courtship?
Oh, not very long. I met him... I guess late June, early July, and we got married in November. We were planning to get married the next summer. And the people in the School of Design where he was teaching said, no, get married at Thanksgiving or Christmas because everybody will be gone next summer. So we moved the wedding up and were married in November. And then the next summer we went to England to meet his family.
Who was your best man at that wedding?
Cecil Elliott. He was one of Lewis's best friends.
He was also an instructor in the school, right?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. So mostly the school people came to the wedding?
My family and the school people, because we were married at George Matsumoto's house. He was an architect on the staff at School Design. And so it had to be a small wedding. and the wedding and the reception was held at their home.
So you took off the next summer for where?
For England, for the summer.
And where all did you go in England?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. All over England and Scotland. We spent the 3 months just traveling.
Oh. So you came back to Raleigh.
Yep.
That fall.
And we, when we came, we had given up his apartment. We had moved into his apartment. And we gave up the apartment and stored the furniture in my brother's garage out in Garner. So when we came back, we stayed with them a few days, and we found a house and bought it.
And where was that house?
On 1322 Mordecai Drive.
The famous Mordecai house, right?
Yeah, the Mordecai house.
You got your pilot's license about this time, didn't you?
Actually, we started taking the lessons in 1956. And we got our license, and Lewis got his license in February of 57. But I had to wait till June to get my license because I was pregnant. And they would not let me solo while it was so near time for my baby.
Well, that makes sense, when you think about it, right?
But yeah, we had our first baby, Nigel, in March of 57. And then I think in June of 57, I then went out and got my, I soloed and worked toward my getting my license. Didn't do me much good. We bought a plane, but Lewis did all the flying. I was co-pilot.
Well, you took a long trip in that plane, didn't you?
Yes. We went to the West Coast and back.
And is instrument flying?
To a certain extent, it was all visual flight rules. But we did depend a lot on the Omni system. And, of course, with map reading. There wasn't that much instruments for small planes back in those days.
What did you do, just take it little hops going across the country?
We worked out that we never got below 3/4 of a tank of fuel for our next stop, our next landing, but we always had an alternate at the halfway point. So Lewis spent hours every night at the hotel looking at the maps and figuring out where the wind was going to be and where we were going.
Well, one of the stops on that trip was in Aspen, Colorado, wasn't it?
Yes, the International Design Festival. Lewis was one of the speakers, and we were there for a week. Now, we did not fly into Aspen. We flew to Denver, and we caught a bus into Aspen, and I'm glad we did. That airport's on the side of a mountain. We went out and looked at it. I said, no way would I want to be in the plane while you land on that little strip.
Right.
It looked like they had just used dynamite just to knock the side of the mountain off, to put a little runway there.
What was your impression of the design conference?
It was very interesting. They had, I can't remember all of the speakers. I remember that Heath from the Heath Pottery Company was on the program. I don't really remember. This is awful.
No, that's okay. Well, after the design conference, you didn't come back east. You kept going west. Where did you go then?
We went, let's see. I think we went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and stayed about a week after that. Then we went out to San Francisco, and we were there. We had met the Heaths, and they were leaving for Europe, and they gave us a key to their, they had a potato barge that they built a house on out in the bay from San Francisco, between San Francisco and Sausalito. And they gave us a key to their house and said, while you're here, while you're in San Francisco, stay in our house. And of course that was very nice, because hotels even in that day were expensive. But of course we found a nice present to leave for them when we left, and we cleaned everything just spotless. But it was beautiful on that bay.
Oh, I bet.
And then when we left there, we flew back down to Los Angeles. I visited Garrett Egbo, who was a friend of Lewis's, landscape architect.
What was Egbo like?
Very nice, down to earth, a wonderful designer. He wrote several books on design. I think Lewis probably has them. I know the school library has them, and Tommy Church. Is it Tommy Church? The name's gone. There's another friend, Bob Royster, also was in Los Angeles. He and Garrett Egbo were partners in their landscape office, and then they separated, had two separate offices. I think, I can't remember if Bob moved to San Diego somewhere, but anyway, they were very nice people. Most landscape architects were really nice, down-to-earth people. There were no pretension and stuff like some of the architects were. They had grandiose ideas. And
well, on the trip back, let's see, you get back to Raleigh and you've got your new house and a new baby. And so did you know that Lewis was going to start a business in your house?
No. It was not discussed. He was doing some little designs for friends on the dining table. And then other people started calling, asking him to do designs for him. And every night when we got ready to eat, everything had to be packed up and moved. So he just went down in the basement, and that was sort of excavated but not finished. It was just dirt. And the only thing down there really was the just the bottom of the floor furnace that was our only source of heat. And he cleaned out a space and paved a floor and built up a sort of a half wall with concrete blocks. And then he decided he wanted an entrance from the house, so where we had, he closed off to put a washing machine for the baby. He put a trap door so we could hop down into the basement from the kitchen.
No kidding.
No ladder or anything, just hop down and step up on the stool and push himself up and sit on the edge of the floor and come in when it's time for supper.
Well, he was getting a lot of clients then at that time.
At that time, it was pretty much small gardens here in Raleigh. And then he started getting larger projects. He met Jim Rouse, and I can't remember, I think he was speaking at University of Maryland or somewhere, and Jim Rouse, who was a developer, came to hear him speak. And he asked Lewis to do some enclosed malls for him. And I believe those were the first enclosed malls in this country.
Do you remember gardens? Do you remember Charlottetown Mall?
Charlottetown, yes.
North Star?
The North Star and Cherry Hill. And oh, I can't remember. I have to go to my jewelry box to see, because every mall that they opened, they had a pair of earrings designed for the women and a tie clasp for the men.
No kidding.
For, as a memento. And there was always a dinner party the night before with the people that worked on it and the presentation of the earrings. So I still have all the earrings.
Well, now, you're saying that Lewis was doing the malls in the basement of Mordecai House? Or had he moved by then?
Well, I think by then we had moved to Ross Kemp Drive, And he had his office in the basement at Roth Gibb Drive. I'm not sure of the dates. I'm really not.
That's okay.
But the funny thing happened, Willie York went to see one of the malls that Lewis had done, and he told Jim, he said, I'm building a little garden over in Cameron Village in Raleigh. Who is your landscape architect? And Jim said, well, you'll have trouble finding him because he lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. And so that was sort of funny that he went to Maryland looking for Lewis, and Lewis was teaching here at State. And of course Lewis did some work for Willie, but the first work was a small garden outside of Ballantyne's.
Was that an unusual garden?
I thought so. I thought it was very nice. I had a lot of comments from the patrons. Everyone liked it.
Was it enclosed?
Partially. Because the restaurant, that part of the restaurant was sort of in the basement from the front, but open at the back. And so that part of the garden was inside and part was outside. It flowed from the closed area that would survive into the fountains and things outside.
When Lewis was designing these, making these designs, did he run them past you?
Not really. He showed them to me. But no, I never had any talent, if that's what you're asking.
Well, I was just wondering, it was like sometimes people have input into projects. I'm sure that you're just being there, you had some input into some of these designs.
Not really.
No?
No.
Were there other people working on, besides Lewis, were there other people working there?
Yes, he made a point of hiring students that needed work. Many of them that were in school had to have part-time jobs. And this was not only a way of having practice and being able to show his work, but it was also a way of helping the students. And I would suspect that 90% of the students worked with him at some point during their time.
Do you remember any of their names?
Yes. There was Lottie Bryan, Warren Edwards, Charlie Burkhead.
Well, we'll think of some more in a little bit, I'm sure.
Probably. There were many of them.
So you're running a household that has a landscape architect business in the basement, and Lewis is teaching full-time. So
and
how
I have a full-time job.
And you have a full-time job. How did you balance all that out?
I don't know. it just worked out.
Were there more children by this time?
Well, let's see, it was 5 years after Nigel's born before we had Jennifer. And by then we were over in on Roth Gibb Drive in the house that had a nice big basement that was actually built to be occupied. But it wasn't that good because I had a typewriter down there, and at night I typed specifications and plant list and had an IBM, beautiful IBM typewriter. But it jammed up because it was so damp in the basement that all the keys rusted.
Oh no.
So we had to buy a new typewriter and keep it upstairs. But then we were building a house on Darien Drive, where we eventually moved, and moved there in 1966 after Lisa was born. And at that time, instead of building a basement for his office, we moved into an office on Hillsborough Street across from the college. And I went over to have lunch with Lewis one day, and we were walking down to the Players' Retreat for a sandwich and spied an old two-story house. They were just putting up a little sale sign. And we went back to the office, and I got in my car and went to see the real estate agent and made an offer on the house. And we moved into that house, that old two-story house.
That's where the old Lemon Tree Inn was finally built, right?
Yeah, we sold the lot to the Lemon Tree Inn, and it used it for their parking lot.
So where did the office go then?
To Coger Center, out on Glenwood Avenue, across the road from Crabtree Valley Mall. I don't know, do they still call it the Coger Center?
Yes. Okay. National Drive?
Yes.
Yeah, that still occurs there. How many employees were there then? I mean, the business has grown.
I can't remember, 8 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time I had sold my insurance agency, and basically I was going into the office to, they had a secretary, and we hired Quinn Tard as a bookkeeper, and I was in there really just to help out. A lot of times I took care of the travel arrangements. Lewis decided that it didn't look right for his wife to be working in the office.
Oh.
So that's when I started my bookstore.
Now, you say you started your bookstore. This is a famous bookstore. You want to tell me what the name of it is?
The Reader's Corner.
Which is still going today.
Still going strong. I still keep the books for them. I go down and collect books to read.
And how did the idea for Reader's Corner get started?
There was a little cubby hole down in Moorhead, the Half Price Bookstore, and we found it one time when we were down on vacation and just fell in love with the place. It was a jumble in there. And I said, gosh, I wish there was one of those in Raleigh. And Lou said, well, you're always starting something. Why don't you start one? So when we came back to Raleigh from that week's vacation, I got busy looking for a location, and I found it over on Hillsborough Street. And that's how it started.
And you just bought books from?
Yeah, I put an ad in the paper to buy books. And I bought books, and then, of course, as soon as I could get the store open, we traded books.
Well, it was a hit from the day one, right?
Pretty much so. It of course, it took a while to build up, but if a customer ever came in, they were hooked, because they'd bring their old books in and trade them to get new books. Sometimes, you know, they'd bring enough books they didn't owe any money. Sometimes they'd empty their closets and get a credit that we put on the books. But that got too complicated, so I bought the first electronic cash register I'd ever really looked at that could print out the receipts and print out the credit slips for them.
So that was an innovation then?
Well, back in those days, they sort of tailored the cash register for my business. The guy spent a day with me in the bookstore asking questions. And then he set it up and told me how to do different things, how to ring in the books, how to ring out the books, how to ring the credit and the difference. And then, of course, if there was any difference in the price of the books, there had to be sales tax on it, which it kept a record of all that. That was a lifesaver.
I guess it was. Well, so you're running the Reader's Corner, and about what year was that? Do you remember?
Started it in, I think, 1974.
Well, I'm going to have to back up a little bit then, because I want to back up to about 1968. And that was the last year that Lewis taught at the School of Design. What was going on in 68 that he had to stop teaching?
I don't really know. He just came home and said he was tired of teaching. He was burned out. He thought that he could make it just in private practice. What did I think? I said, I think whatever you want to do. And he said, I think I'm going to give my notice and not teach after this. Yeah, I said, okay. So that's what he did.
Just did it one day.
Well, I knew he wasn't really that happy, and he was rushing off to jobs and coming back and working on doing lectures and things. And he was very busy. He had too much work to do. He had too many employees. It was limited to what I could do and the other people could do. He brought it up, and I said, well, just go ahead and quit. And of course, it worked out all right.
Well, that was that a turning point year as far as jobs go, changing from residential to more commercial?
Well, he was already doing commercial. And he had, I believe he had the airplane, the second airplane. He'd gone from the, what we call the push-pull Cessna to a Cessna 310. I had a full-time pilot.
And he was flying to conferences? And
he was flying to conferences, flying to jobs. He was doing a lot of work down in, for the, can't remember the name of the firm in Atlanta. He did the Palmetto Dunes project on Hilton Head Island. He had work in Florida. He, of course, worked in Texas.
Just a lot of work was taking time away from the teaching and the teaching.
Well, no,
he was
always home in time to be at his classes. But it was difficult for him. He would sometimes fly in after midnight, get up the next morning, run to the office and work, come home, have lunch, and go teach in the afternoon. He was teaching 3 afternoons a week. It was a lot of work for him. And he felt that he was sort of burned out, was not giving the students what he thought they should have.
Did that make, after it was decided, were you glad that that's the way that things turned out?
I don't think it really made that much difference, whatever he wanted to do. Whether it was teaching or doing a private practice. There had been some problems in some of the students resenting him because he had become quite famous. He'd been Tar Heel of the Week. He had won awards for his work. He was in all the landscape magazines as well as architecture magazines. And so there was some, I called it jealousy.
Was there a court case at one point?
I don't think so. They said they were going to sue him. Then they came to the school and talked to the dean because they had been his students. And the dean said, you can't teach if you don't practice. How can you help teach people if you can't do it yourself? And I will not restrict my faculty. And so Dean Kampfner stood up for all of his faculty members and insisted that they be allowed to practice. And of course it was a little uncomfortable when we went to landscape meetings, knowing how those two people felt.
Well, we're talking about Bell and Godwin, right?
Yes.
And I mention that because that court case is a part of Lewis's papers, and we've read that.
Oh, it was a court case.
It never went to court.
I didn't remember it going to court. That's why.
It was like you said, it was settled outside of the courtroom, mm-hmm. But it was the preparation for it was just anything. It was just short of going to be filed.
Mm-hmm.
But the, as you mentioned, the remarkable thing was that Dean Kampfner stood up for for his faculty in letting them practice and supporting them if they wanted to practice. So,
well, he encouraged that they practice or write or do other things.
How was Dean Kep Hefner in other ways?
He was a nice person. Mabel, his wife, was a good cook. They were always having dinner parties and things. But this goes back a long time.
Well, talking about dinner parties, you entertained quite a few people at your house too, didn't you, for visiting people that were visiting?
Yes. We had lots of them stay with us, and I had at least two dinners a year for the students and their wives or girlfriends.
Do you remember some of the people that used to come in into town?
Well, of course, Egbo came with it, stayed with us when he came to teach, and so did Bob Royston. Bob came after we moved into Darien. Garrett stayed with us when we were over on North Bear. Sam, I was trying to remember, I think it was Samuel Newsom did Japanese Gardens. He and his wife came to, teach, and his wife came with him. They stayed with us. Quite a lot of the people stayed with us, as well as us having dinner parties for them or cocktail parties. Back in those days, a cocktail party was sort of the easy way. Put out lots of junk food and feed them some alcohol.
What was it like living in the Darien Drive house?
Well, it was a big house, but I did not have good storage, and the ledges that were over the living room that were supposed to be reflections for the fluorescent lighting that was at the back that reflected on the roof. I used that for storage. I put boxes and lined the books up there. And the children had lofts that they were supposed to be able to play in, but I used their lofts for storage. I tried to talk to Lewis about it when he was designing the house. And he said, "I'm not catering to your squirreling instincts." Now, I'm a pack rat. There's no doubt about that, but I had Christmas decorations that had belonged to my mother and my grandmother, and I had a number of things that I felt that I wanted to keep, and I wanted some storage for them. To this day, I don't know if he really understands what I was trying to tell him, that to build me a basement or an attic. But he actually had dirt hauled in and it compacted so that he could put that house on a slab about 7 feet up in the air. And the only basement was about 10 feet wide through there, so that the furnace for that section of the house could, and the hot water heater under the kitchen could go down there. And every time I went down to the garbage cans and climbed those 14 steps up to that ledge on the back, I thought, why didn't he let me have a basement?
Well, how long did y'all stay in the Darien Drive house?
We moved, like I said, we moved in 1966 and we separated in, I think, 1975. And as soon as he insisted I had to have the house, I started looking for something else. It was a beautiful house, just to look at it. And it was nice for entertaining. But like I said,
Was there an issue about how far it was from the bedrooms to the kitchen?
Well, Gil Thurlow used to say that I could walk to the Capitol and back for the length of time it took me to get from the bedroom to the kitchen. And it was a long way.
And the reason that you'd be making trips from the bedroom to the kitchen because there was a new baby, right?
That's right.
Had to warm the baby's milk up.
Yeah, that's right.
But I wonder sometimes if the modernists really do look at how people actually live when they design their houses.
Probably not. Like I said, he would not. He just would not cater to my squirreling instincts.
Well, thinking back over the period of time that you can recall, which Lewis Clark Associates project stands out to you and why? You mentioned Palmetto Dunes.
Well, that was beach property, and of course I liked the beach. I liked walking on the beach. I liked the ocean. It was a nice design. But I think the thing that, one of the things I enjoyed was the Cherry Hill Mall. It was a beautiful mall. I think that was one of the first ones. I'm not sure. A lot of the projects, I still have some memories of them.
Anything here in Raleigh?
Well, of course, the Ballantine Garden at Willie York I had over in Cameron Village. Sure, we had lots of work here.
There were a lot of people's, some homes, a lot of homes.
Well, there was a Dr. Jenkins house that he did over in Country Club Hills. Yana, isn't this awful?
No, it's not awful. You don't worry about it. We're almost done, Kit, believe it or not. What is the one important thing to know about Lewis Clark?
Well, I think that you'd have to say he loved his profession. He cared deeply about his students. And he was very dependable. If he gave you his word, he kept it. I'm sure there are other things as well, but right off, just thinking, I would say that those things were important to him.
What's the one important thing to know about Kit Clark?
I guess I'm a survivor.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Not that I can think of. I'll probably think of a million things after.
Well, we'll have another session then.
But it's strange, I haven't talked about this, and all of a sudden it's just some of the memories are coming back, but you have to remember I'm almost 80 now.
Well, your memory's pretty good. Yeah. Well, if you can't think of anything else for right now, and we'll leave this open to have another session. If you have, if you think of something else, write it down, jot it down, and we'll schedule another session. Mm-hmm. But I think we're to our stopping point, and
okay.
I just want to thank you very much for talking to us today.
Well, you're surely welcome, and I hope it'll be some help, and of course you'll need to do some editing, I'm sure.
Oh, we'll do fine.